Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-1410 et al. American Farm Bureau Federation et al. Petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency. Issue 1. Issues related to fine particle standards. Mr. Myers for state petitioners, Mr. Court for environmental petitioners, and Mr. Link for the EPA.
Good morning, Your Honors. For today's argument, Mr. Court and I will both be covering issues related to the annual PM 2.5 standard. Mr. Court will be separately addressing the issue of the secondary PM 2.5 standard. This case is about a killer pollutant. Fine particulate matter, or PM 2.5, are microparticles that can lodge deep in the lung, causing lung damage and even death. EPA has determined that more than 100 million people in this country are vulnerable to PM 2.5. In this rulemaking, the EPA administrator's staff and his independent science advisors both determined that the annual standard needed to be strengthened to protect public health. Because the administrator's unprecedented decision to reject their advice lacked a reasoned basis, the rule should be remanded. I'd like to touch on 2 points. First, how the annual standard fails to protect against the risk of death from long-term exposure, and then with respect to the risk of illness. The annual standard does not provide an adequate margin of safety against the risk of death from long-term exposure. As this court has repeatedly held, most recently in the American Trucking Association versus EPA, the statute's adequate margin of safety language requires EPA to err on the side of caution in setting the NACs, and the need to do so here was especially compelling given the seriousness of the impacts of PM 2.5 and the millions of people vulnerable. Now, both CASAC and EPA staff concluded that the scientific evidence justified lowering the annual standard below 15, citing to both short-term and long-term exposure studies showing a link between death and exposure where the average annual concentrations were below 15. In particular, CASAC cited to cities such as Detroit and St. Louis that have relatively high annual PM 2.5 concentrations but little daily variation, so that merely lowering the 24-hour standard would not sufficiently address the risk of death in those areas. Now, EPA's health risk assessment provided some quantification of that concern. In our reply brief at page 9, we explain how the standard set at 15 for the annual and 35 for the 24-hour will allow more than 1,300 deaths annually from long-term exposure in the 9 cities analyzed. Now, had the administrator followed CASAC's recommendation to lower the standard to 13, more than 500 deaths could be averted annually in just 3 cities. Now, I'd like to add page 23 of our opening brief where we make that point about the comparison between the 15 standard and the 13 standard. We refer to Detroit and St. Louis and Pittsburgh. In fact, instead of Pittsburgh, the reference should have been to Los Angeles. And I'd like to direct the court to pages 2408 to 2409 for the numbers for Los Angeles. That, if you add in the deaths that could potentially be averted in just those 3 cities, you get significantly towards that 1,300 death number that I mentioned earlier. In other words, the administrator had a scientifically justifiable approach to significantly address the risk of premature death in these areas, and he declined to do so. That decision was arbitrary, and furthermore, his grounds of uncertainty is inconsistent with this court's precedent that in setting the NACs, EPA is required to err on the side of caution. My second point, the annual standard does not provide an adequate margin of safety against the risk of illness. In the Lead Industries decision, this court stated that the adequate margin of safety language requires protection not just against effects that have been conclusively determined in the scientific evidence, but also provide a layer of protection against effects that are still somewhat uncertain. And here, with respect to risk of illness, EPA staff found the Gouderman studies, to be fairly strong evidence of irreversible lung damage in children from long-term exposure to PM2.5, where the average concentrations are 15, the same number that the administrator argues here reasonably protects public health. Now, the administrator claims that he reasonably disregarded these studies in setting the national standard because it was merely an isolated study and the effects have not been demonstrated in other studies. As we explain in our reply brief, that characterization as an isolated study is erroneous. And I point the court in particular to pages 924 to 925 of the Joint Appendix, where EPA staff explains how the findings of the Gouderman study built on the findings of an earlier 24-city study that was done in the last NAAQS review, showing that the Gouderman studies were not merely isolated. But more fundamentally, the administrator's decision to ignore the Gouderman study in setting the level of the annual standard is inconsistent with the lead industry's decision, where this court said that the adequate margin of safety is supposed to build in some protection against effects that haven't been conclusively determined. And here we're talking about irreversible lung damage in children. Not only is his decision on this study inconsistent with lead industries, but it's also inconsistent with what EPA is arguing here in defending the PM10 standard. Directing the court to pages 103 to 104 of EPA's brief, there EPA argues, in the face of uncertainty, EPA is required to err on the side of caution in interpreting the scientific evidence, especially given the serious health impacts of PM2.5 and the millions of people vulnerable to it. I'm sorry, to PM and the millions of people vulnerable to it. At a minimum, remand of the rule is necessary because nowhere in the record did EPA explain how an annual standard of 15 adequately protects sensitive populations with an adequate margin of safety from illness. Now, the administrator made his decision to keep the standard at 15 based on two mortality studies. With respect to morbidity or illness, there's no explanation in the record how the standard set at 15 will protect sensitive populations from morbidity. And as this court stated in the American Lung Association versus EPA case, because setting the NAAQS involves a situation where literally lives hang in the balance, EPA has the heaviest of obligations.
Counsel, are there available morbidity studies?
Are there available
Yes.
morbidity studies? Yes, the Gouderman studies that
Other than Gouderman, is that the only thing in the record we have that deals?
Well, we also have the 24-city studies that I mentioned earlier that EPA staff concluded complemented the Gouderman study in terms of the findings with respect to where lung damage was occurring in terms of the level of the average annual concentration. And the 24-city study, it was right around 15 as well. So those two studies complement each other, making it even more important that the administrator look at that study in determining where to set the annual level.
And what is it the administrator, were you saying the administrator said nothing about this?
No, the administrator considered this study and decided to give it no weight, Your Honor.
Said there was an insufficient basis on which to formulate a standard, didn't he?
He did, that's right.
And what page is that in the final rule?
Let's see. I believe it's 61173, or let's see. Let's see.
I think it's 176, 410 in the JA, if I've got the right place.
Yes, Your Honor. That's right. Mm-hmm. So
he says, the administrator further stresses that he's placing the greatest weight, et cetera, levels associated with mortality in those two studies, the same two, right? This is this standard is also basically at the same level as the long-term average in the two morbidity studies, 24 cities and Southern California Children's Cohort Study. Right, so I guess those are the two. Is that Gouderman?
Yes.
Okay, good.
There's the Gouderman study, and then there's the 24-city study, which is referred to, I think, as RAISE-EN on that page, Your Honor.
So here he's saying these morbidity studies provide an uncertain basis for setting the level of the national standard, and therefore do not warrant setting a lower level for the annual standard than the level warranted based on the key mortality studies.
That's right, Your Honor. And EPA staff cited the Gouderman study as fairly strong evidence that adverse effects were occurring where the average concentration was 15. So they cited that study along with, you know, noting that it was complemented by this 24-city study as a basis for setting the standard at 13.
What did the CASAC say about that?
CASAC did not, in the information in the record anyway, comment specifically on the Gouderman study. They did note that adverse effects had been shown in the scientific evidence that was in the record that where the average concentrations were below or at or below the standard of 15, and the Gouderman study would fall into that category. I'd also note, Your Honor, that there is discussion about this on page 61-172 of the record, which is Joint Appendix 406. And that's where it states.
What column is that?
Third column, about halfway down.
Go ahead.
Okay. And there the administrator states that the Gouderman studies were important new findings regarding the health of long-term exposure on children.
Right. But then ultimately, that's the California.
That's right, Your Honor, Southern California.
And then says, well, it's one location. It's not enough on which to base a standard.
Right. That's why I think staff's citation to the 24-city study is important, because it shows that these effects can occur at levels not just in this particular geographic area.
Same effects?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, they were both concerned lung damage. The Gouderman study covered a little different type of lung damage, which is decreased lung function growth. I think the 24-city study dealt with a different type of lung damage, but they're both under the category of lung damage to children.
All right. So, okay. Tell me a little more. What was the staff's observation about that?
Staff's observation about the Gouderman study was that it was fairly strong evidence that the effects of lung damage occur where the average annual average concentration was 15 or below. So they cited that as a basis for an annual standard of 13.
Right, so I guess at the place where you referred us, 172?
Yes, Your Honor.
Columns 2 and 3. Is it there? I think it might be that where the administrator says about the 24 cities study, that it was a point study, just a single time, right, that was looked at.
Right.
Statistically significant associations were reported between long-term fine particle exposures and lung function measures at a single point in time, whereas positive but generally not statistically significant associations were reported with prevalence of several respiratory conditions. As interpreted in the last review, the results of the 24-city study are uncertain as to the extent to which the association extends below a long-term mean PM2.5 concentration of approximately 15 microns.
That's right, Your Honor. I think
so
that's probably...
That's the reason that he gives for rejecting that, then goes on to give a reason dealing with the Southern California cohort study.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So he gave a reason. What's wrong with the reason he gave?
Well, the reason that he gave, first of all, is inconsistent. His characterization of the study as an isolated one, I think, is inconsistent with staff's conclusion that the 24-city study was complementary.
Well, wait a second. Is it or is it not a point in time that was studied?
I think it was, Your Honor. So yes.
He got that right.
Yes, I believe so.
He describes it and says that's a limitation that makes it insufficient as a basis for decision.
Right. So that... Back in 1997, when the administrator decided then not to lower the level of the annual standard based solely on the 24-city study, that might have been a reasonable determination back then. But now you have the Gouderman study, which builds upon, it's not directly the same study, but it does show adverse effects.
Right. So the 24-city study was rejected and, well, was insufficient, in, regards insufficient in 97 to form a basis.
Yep.
So the incremental change here is the Gouderman study.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that is the study that looks only at one place in Southern California.
Yeah, I believe it was 12 communities in Southern California that children in fourth grade and seventh grade were studied.
Mm-hmm. And is there a reason to believe that children in Southern California are different from children in other parts of the United States? I mean, it may be that it's a single study involving a single set of children, but why? Is there a reason why, does the administrator suggest or does anybody suggest a reason why it can't be generalized?
No, Your Honor. The only point...
The administrator suggested that it was the pollutants differ from one place to another.
That's right. Yes, he does make that point.
That was the whole point of why one location, unlike the 24 cities study, one location didn't add much.
That's right, Your Honor. But, again... I guess there are two points. First is that, you know, based on this court's precedent in setting the adequate margin of safety, there's supposed to be built in a layer of protection where effects haven't yet been conclusively determined.
That's true, but we're also supposed to see to that with a level of significant level of deference to this kind of issue, where analysis, where the administrator is looking at a technical study and making a judgment about it. Not an unexplained aspect of the decision. There may be others, but this is not an unexplained aspect of the decision.
That's correct, Your Honor. The administrator...
You just think it's insufficiently cautious.
That's correct, given this court's precedent. That's right.
Is there additional evidence besides these studies, say either clinical or biological evidence, that would suggest that people start having morbidity problems before the moment at which they die?
Your Honor, there are...
It seems logical that that would be the case. So that if you set a standard for when it causes death, you might think that it causes wheezing sometime before that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, is there data or are there studies that would support that in the record?
I believe there are some studies in the record that support that other than the Gouderman study. I don't have those at my fingertips, but I will look for those. Your Honor, and I did, to get back to Judge Ginsburg's question, just wanted to refer the court to page 1880. Of the joint appendix, that's where in the staff paper, EPA staff concludes that the Gouderman study provides a basis to set the standard at 13.
When the staff makes a recommendation like that, I think it's important to have some concept of what that means for the administrator's decision. And I take it that it means that the administrator had better deal with it like any public comment that deserves the weight that it's persuasive weight. It's not a binding in any way on the administrator except creating an obligation to disagree.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Disagree, to deal with it, either agree or disagree.
That's right. Yes.
And is that any different than a public comment?
Well, I think EPA staff certainly brings a level of expertise that some of us who make public comments probably don't have.
Well, the American Lung Association seems to have some expertise in this.
Absolutely. I think a related point.
They're on your brief with you, right?
What's that?
Aren't they on your brief? Oh, they're on another brief, right. Not your brief. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, and they submitted comments here that a standard of 12 was justified based on the scientific evidence.
Right. I don't think they raised the point that there were unaddressed or inadequately addressed studies on this subject. That's your point.
I'm not sure with respect to morbidity, but getting to the point
that you're... We'll hear from them and find out.
Right. But getting to the point that you're making, Your Honor, Congress did intend, based on the legislative history, that CASAC's recommendations would be afforded greater emphasis than a public comment would. In our opening brief at page 5, we note that based on the legislative history...
Well, we don't need legislative history to know that they're an expert body.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. The only point that I was going to make is that There's a specific reference in the legislation to the courts considering CASAC's findings when looking at the administrator's failure or refusal to set or revise such a standard and acts with respect to any pollutant.
And the statute says they have to explain their differences. The administrator has to explain his differences from CASAC.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm not sure where I am on the clock.
We certainly don't need legislative history. Thank you, Mr. Myers.
I'd reserve any additional time I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
Actually, you owe us a few minutes. but we'll see what we can do.
Okay, thank you.
Court, before you begin your argument on other points, I wonder if you can shed any light on the discussion we've just had in your capacity here for the ALA.
The American Lung Association and Environmental Petitioners incorporated states' arguments in their briefs, but
didn't add anything. We agree with them.
Right. We did not address these long-term studies, particularly because we didn't feel like we need to rehash the same territory.
So we're not missing anything, or the other brief is not missing anything in this regard?
No, I would say no.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Paul Court for Environmental Petitioners. I would like to address two issues this morning, whether the standards are adequate to address public health impacts caused by short-term exposures, and whether those standards are adequate to address adverse visibility impacts. By focusing on a standard that shaves off only the worst polluted days and refusing to lower the annual standard, EPA cannot demonstrate that the day-to-day short-term exposures that will be allowed under these standards will protect public health with an adequate margin of safety. There's no dispute in this case that first, under the old standards, short-term exposures were unsafe. Second, that these problems occur not just on the worst 2% of days or only on days with concentrations above 35 micrograms per cubic meter. And third, that in order to defend the standards, EPA needs to show that the level of short-term pollution allowed on all days, peak and non-peak, will be safe. EPA admits that this is the test, but EPA never makes a demonstration in this record that all days will be protected with an adequate margin of safety. CASAC and every major public health and medical association agree that EPA needed to lower the annual standard in order to address the average daily short-term exposures to which people would be exposed. EPA, however, refused arbitrarily even to look at average daily levels allowed under the annual standard. EPA bases this refusal not on any scientific argument, but on a transparent play on words. EPA now argues that we have... hopefully it will be transparent by the end of this argument.
Well, your point is that it was foggy.
EPA now says that we have a short-term standard in the form of the 24-hour limit and a long-term standard in the form of the annual. But both the 24-hour and the annual limit are limits on daily exposures. One sets a limit on the peak daily exposure, and then the other limits the average daily exposure. As state petitioners argued, EPA's decision, therefore, refusal to evaluate the annual standard against these short-term studies is plainly contrary to this court's mandate that EPA consider all relevant studies in setting the standard.
Is this the issue on which the agency said that it expected that measures taken to comply with the short-term standards would have the desired effect?
Right.
There's been some proportional reductions.
Right. That's the assertion. That's what this whole argument hangs on.
Is that accurate that there were proportional reductions under the prior standard, or the existing standard that was unchanged?
Not exactly. What they cite to is a footnote in a two-page memo that says in two cities, when they looked at the natural fluctuations of PM 2.5 standards from 1 year to the next, they saw that everything moved proportionally. The high and the low moved proportionally.
Philadelphia
and Los Angeles.
What's the distinction that you're drawing between natural and other fluctuations?
Well, that footnote says specifically that this fluctuation was not the result of any strategies, any plans to address the PM 2.5 standards, because these studies were done before those PM 2.5 standards were even adopted. So, and that point is important to understand, because when you set a limit that says you have to make sure the peak exposures don't exceed this level, the strategies that you design focus on shaving off those worst pollution days. So, for example, if you are in an area that has strong seasonal sources, you may have low day-to-day pollution levels. They're still causing problems, mind you. But then high swings, high peaks when those seasonal sources are in operation. You would design a strategy to regulate those seasonal sources, to bring those peak days down. In other areas, like cities, you may not have that fluctuation. Your day-to-day levels may be fairly high, but you don't have those large swings. And that was Kasach's point. Kasach said that studies show that these short-term exposure problems persist even in areas that do not have high peaks, that would not be affected at all by this peak standard. The other problem with this peak approach and the assumption that all the days will be shifted is that there's no connection between peak levels and day-to-day levels. Again,
no known connection.
No, if you look in the record, for example, if you look at EPA's summary of all the short-term studies, and that's, let's see, at JA993, they provide a table of all the numbers. And you can look down through these columns, and you can see that you may have areas that all have similar annual average levels, but have radically different peak exposure days. And again, this EPA acknowledges this in the record, that there are some areas where you have seasonal sources and you have a high, what they call, peak to mean ratio. And in other areas, you don't have those wild swings. So it varies from area to area, and there's no established connection that if you lower the peak, that will translate into lowering the day-to-day. All they have is that one footnote, and it doesn't actually say what they say it says.
Where is the footnote?
The footnote that they refer to is in this APT or ABT study, and it's at the record on page 2319.
Give me a moment on that.
Yeah.
I'm looking at 2163, which I thought was the right place where they addressed this in text, and there's no footnote there. I'm sorry, the page again, 2319?
2319. That's the actual study that they point to.
So your point is where it says, none of the data reflected efforts to meet 2.5 standards because this exercise and the data it used preceded
right.
the setting of those
right.
standards.
Right. And that's supported, well, let me give you three other reasons why this.
Okay. Then what do you make in the next sentence? That investigation, however, found that the change in the distribution of 2.5 concentrations from 1 year to another in the same location tended to be linear.
Right. That's what they rely on. They say, look, it tends to be linear when these things change from year to year. But that's not the result of any strategy to reduce those emissions. That's just how things change naturally.
What if they had said, I'm not sure they said this, but what if they had said, there's this, it seems from the data that, I mean, and I realize you can contest that when steps are taken to lower the peak, there seems to be a proportional lowering across the board.
Right.
We don't understand why.
Right.
But we think that that's likely to, and they say likely, that's likely to recur in the future. Again, we don't understand why.
Right.
And so rather than hold up the rule to try to figure it out, we're going to go with that and see what happens.
As a hypothetical, you know, maybe they could offer some empirical data to show, you know, how these strategies translate. But we point out...
That's your objection to the on the table data, right?
That's one objection. And we point out that in 1997, EPA had this same internal debate, and they explained with multiple reasons why a strategy that relies on the peak exposures only will not lead to the right day-to-day levels of pollution.
And then they say it seems we were wrong.
Without explaining what new data has led them to change.
Isn't this a refreshing departure from the rationalist fallacy in which they pretend to know everything?
I'll take that as a rhetorical question. The other two problems, fundamental problems, is that even if you assume that it's proportional, what does that mean about the day-to-day levels that will result? Because they refuse to look at what the average day-to-day exposure should be or that would be safe, there's no way for them to say, if we, you know, even if everything moves proportionally because it varies from city to city, that the result is going to be safe. They've never answered that question, what the day-to-day exposure should be like. And then the final problem with this claim is that, again, this only works in areas that have high peak days. In the cities that like Detroit and St. Louis that CASAC was pointing out, this standard wouldn't do anything because they don't have peak days that extend above the 35 microgram per meter cubed limit. If I could turn quickly to the secondary standard, just to sort of sum up the issue there.
Let me first congratulate you on including pictures in the something done all too rarely by advocates.
Yes, though we do get a lot of flack about those pictures.
Now we count those as 10,000 words against your plan.
I was actually waiting for that joke. Yeah.
You can take that as rhetorical.
Just to sum up the secondary issue here, EPA rejected without any explanation the recommendation of EPA staff and CASAC that was developed with a substantial body of evidence that a separate daytime standard was necessary to address adverse visibility impacts. The result is a standard EPA has adopted that has not been shown to provide any improvement in areas with acknowledged impaired visibility. And since I'm well over my time, I'll take questions or wrap it up there.
Thank you, Mr. Cole.
I have one question. On the question, let me get this wrong. They suggest that setting them equal is equivalent to the alternative recommended by CASAC, right?
Right.
Would you regard that as a transparent play on words also?
I would, because, you know, in CASAC's own words, when they, like, wrote their final letter, they said that continuing to rely on these primary standards will result in visibility impacts continuing to deteriorate across the country. I don't think CASAC saw it as equivalent, and I think in our briefs we explained...
And that's because they use a four-hour standard.
Yes, right, right.
Mr. Quirk, where did you raise this point, or did you raise this point before the agency?
CASAC raised this point.
CASAC said it's a numerical coincidence.
Right.
That's all they said. Right. They didn't go on to say what should be done or...
No. Well, I'm not sure.
Why it might have occurred or anything else.
No, they didn't. They did, but, you know, that is our point as well, that this is, you know, you look at these two tables.
I understand that, but if they say, you know, here's this association, and we come in and say, that's a numerical coincidence, here's what you need. It sort of cries out for suggesting how to avoid that error or what should be done in the analysis corrected?
I guess so, but I think they understood what CASAC was telling them, that the comparison of these two tables doesn't mean anything because the resulting similarity in the number of counties, it's an apples to oranges comparison, and it's just a coincidence that they're similar.
A little more. If they also said that the population covered mm-hmm. by the 24 counties or 24%, whatever it was, and 27 were roughly the same too. This is the number of millions of people.
Right.
So they've said, well, it covers about the same number of people if we do it this way or we do it that way.
Right. But they knew. They knew that the way to resolve this is to say, look, these monitors were located in the same places. These are the same we know they're not the same monitors because the table explains, you know, we had 162, you know, counties covered by monitors in this study and 200 and something covered in this kind. So we know we're not dealing with the same set of monitors. And so rather than explain, you know, no, it's not a numerical coincidence. These are the same areas. The response.
They're not the same areas. What if they just have the same affect the same number of people, but in different, somewhat in different areas?
Well,
not, you know, does a lot or a little in different areas, and they say, well, it has about the same efficacy as the other approach.
But again, it's an apples to oranges comparison. So it's not answering the question of whether a secondary standard would provide additional benefit. I mean, that's the basis of their argument, is a secondary standard won't provide any additional benefit. But if these are separate areas, then what that table is showing you is that in addition to the population that's protected by the primary standard, this additional population will be protected by the secondary standard. So
that's nowhere in CASAC's letter.
Well, except to say that this comparison
is
a coincidence.
That's where they stop.
Right, right.
So
I'm
wondering whether this is fair notice of the argument that you're making. I mean, if you say these are apples and oranges, I don't know whether you're talking about different colors or that one is citrus and one is not, or
right.
What your point is.
Right. Well, I believe the EPA was aware of what CASAC's point was, and
they've no evidence of it.
Well, and
it's your point, isn't it?
Yeah, and their response was fairly amazing, which was, you know, we don't think that the fact that there was this numerical coincidence, you know, undermines our analysis. But there was no analysis. There was nothing to explain why a 24-hour standard would provide any visibility protection. What visibility protection? What level of visibility protection that 24-hour standard was achieved? The administrator punted on all of this, saying it's subjective. But, you know, this is no more
subjective. You said what was subjective was those studies, staff studies involving showing pictures to people and asking them how much is too much. Impairment.
Well, they said the determination of a level of, you know, adequate visibility is a subjective.
And a metric for the public welfare vis-a-vis visibility is a very difficult thing to quantify.
Right, but you know, as we point out in our briefs, that doesn't mean you aren't obligated to provide a rational basis. You can't just assert that it's subjective and walk away. That you have all this evidence out there, not just the photographic evidence, but economic valuation evidence.
What was that?
The economic valuation evidence. I don't have it at my fingertips, but they looked at, you know, how you would, based on,
Was it surveys again of people asking people, you know, how much this is worth to them, or was it actual economic evidence? Condominiums, whether high-rise apartments with a good view command more than hazy views?
To be honest, I don't know how the studies were designed, but I believe that it was that sort of thing, you know, pricing on real estate in between, you know, different areas with, you know, different visibilities. I know there's some national park data on, you know.
Get some references to the record on that.
Yeah, I can bring that in rebuttal. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mm. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Link. I'm from the Department of Justice on behalf of EPA, and I will address the PM 2.5 issues in this case. I'd like to start with where you left off with regard to PM 2.5 primary standards, and that was the reasonable explanation EPA gave for its change in approach from 1997 in terms of how it used the suite of standards together, annual and 24-hour. In the 1997 rulemaking, EPA had acknowledged that it was theoretically possible to use a 24-hour standard to drive down the distribution of PM 2.5 concentrations. But at that time, it concluded that an annual standard could do so more reliably and with more certainty. It had different evidence in front of it, or additional evidence in this rulemaking, specifically the study you were just talking about, ABT Associates. And I'd like to read you some language that will help answer the questions you were asking about whether that study was looking at the effect of control strategies versus natural fluctuation. Specifically, in 2163 of the Joint Appendix, it's the staff, and this is a staff paper where I'm reading from. The staff states, "We recognize that the historic changes in PM 2.5 have not been the result of a PM 2.5 control strategy, but they likely result from control programs for PM 10 and control programs for other pollutants, especially sulfur and nitrogen oxides." And they also noted it was interesting that the reductions in Philadelphia and Los Angeles were both similarly proportional, given that they very likely had very different reductions in terms of types of emissions over this period.
But the next sentence cuts the other way. The staff says, "The pattern of changes that have occurred in the past therefore may not necessarily reflect the changes that result from future efforts to attain 2.5 standards."
That's true, but reading it with the prior sentence in mind, what it's talking about is that there might be a somewhat different effect for PM 2.5 control specifically than for PM 10. But clearly we're not talking about simply natural fluctuation. We are talking about at least some evidence that a control strategy aimed at meeting a daily standard can also shift the distribution of lower concentration levels downward.
Well, it may not be natural fluctuations, but it's they're identifying something other than the prior efforts to control 2.5.
That's true. So it's essentially imperfect evidence, but it is evidence.
The point is, the petitioner's point is not that it's natural, it's that it was not attributable to prior efforts to control particulate matter.
Well, but actually they refer specifically to prior efforts to control PM10. And of course, until 1997, there was no PM 2.5 indicator. So what they're referring to is efforts to implement the 87 max.
Right.
Was that an annual standard or a daily standard?
That well, there was an annual and a daily standard in the 1987 max.
If there was an annual standard, then maybe it's responding to an annual. You have both an annual and a daily. I thought your point was...
Well, we have the same now, but I mean, the question is, what they were looking at is evidence that control strategies of some sort have been put in place, and peak concentrations in response to those strategies have gone down, and so have concentrations in the lower part of the distribution.
I thought your argument was that that this was evidence that the annual standard wasn't necessary for this.
Well, I wouldn't say evidence that it wasn't necessary, but evidence that both of these standards potentially can be used to drive down the distribution.
Well, how do you know, if you're looking at PM10, how do you know it's not the annual standard for PM10 that's driving this down?
I don't know if this tells me enough to know that for certain, but...
Given your argument about the double regulation with respect to it.
Well, I guess I would say this. There is some uncertainty there. However... the staff agreed that it was a reasonable assumption to take that the 24-hour standard could drive down distributions, and so did CASAC. CASAC, in its letter commenting on the staff paper in June 2005, agreed with the emphasis on reducing the 24-hour standard and cited several arguments in favor of that.
Well, they were in favor of reducing the 24-hour standard, but they were not in favor of the annual. Where you end up with the annual, given where you've ended up with the 24-hour.
You're right. They did not want to leave the annual unchanged, but they did not raise any question as to whether the thinking that a 24-hour standard could be used to drive down distributions of air quality was sound. They agree with that approach, and they even agreed with placing greater emphasis on it, which is their word.
I understand that, but general agreement with an approach is not the same thing as where the approach ends up.
Well,
they obviously don't think that your approach is sufficient.
It's important, though, because it reflects the fact that the agency was on the right track in looking at short-term studies to control short-term effects and long-term studies to control long-term effects.
Case X say that you should not look at all at the, when you say short-term, at the short-term studies to figure out long-term effects?
Well, to be honest, their advice changed a little bit. In the June 2005 letter, the one reason they cited as to why the annual standard should not be left in place was that there were some cities with relatively high long-term average concentration levels, but that didn't have great variability from day to day. It wasn't until their second letter asking for reconsideration of the proposed rule that they cited the short-term studies. But EPA explained why it had looked at those short-term studies and the risk assessment and concluded that both did not create a basis for moving further down. For example, we've heard about some short-term studies that have long-term means at 13. Well, two of those studies also have a 24-hour 98th percentile value that is well above the level at which EPA set the daily standard. The third city is Phoenix, a city in which there were actually mixed results because there was one study that reported significant associations with health effects at a level of 32, but there were two other studies that did not report significant associations with health effects. And those are discussed in the final rule preamble. There was also mixed results nationally in terms of looking at all of the short-term studies between the level of 30 and 35. The administrator noted that this Phoenix study was the only one that had shown significant associations. Others had mixed results. So certainly EPA did consider the additional evidence that KSAC brought to its attention, but it considered it by looking at where to put the daily standard in conjunction with the annual standard. And again, that basic approach was not questioned as to whether it was valid. If I can turn briefly to the risk assessment, state petitioners are now citing a different number of premature deaths calculated by the risk assessment than they did in their original brief. It's because they're looking at a different assumed threshold that was used to generate results. But I think the point they're missing is none of those figures are demonstrated impacts. They are all based on assumptions about whether there is a threshold and where it might be. KSAC, in its comments to the administrator, advised that at levels under 13, the data become much more difficult to interpret and much more research is needed to evaluate what the concentration response relationship is and whether there is a threshold and what the curve looks like. Well, all of the assumed thresholds in the risk assessment are below 13. So really, there's no way to distinguish the results that they generate in terms of their likelihood. They're all assumptions. They all served a purpose in that they allowed the administrator to decide, should I make any change in the standards at all? But he concluded that they weren't reliable enough to allow him to pick precisely what level or what degree of revision was sufficient to protect public health. And his explanation for that was certainly rational. And I'd also like to point out, and this is in response to one of the arguments in the reply brief, the uncertainty in that risk assessment is not just an incorporation of the uncertainty in the epidemiologic studies. For example, the risk assessment report at 2177 in the joint appendix notes that there is uncertainty about how transferable the concentration response functions from the original locations and time periods of the underlying studies as to whether they are reliably transferable to the locations and time periods that were used in the risk assessment. And the risk assessment poses the additional problem that when you look at each more stringent suite of standards, you inevitably get a lower number of deaths, which makes it look as if the obvious answer is to go to the lowest suite. The problem is it doesn't tell you anything about the increase in uncertainty that you're getting as you explore concentrations at those lower levels.
I ask you to back up just for a moment over the argument we were talking about before about whether the short-term studies were disregarded in setting the annual. You started talking about the differences in Phoenix and Santa Clara.
Yes.
Was that discussed in the Federal Register as an explanation for not considering the short-term when setting the annual?
Yes, it was discussed in the...
Can you tell me where that is in the final rule?
Specifically in... I would refer you particularly to 402 in the joint appendix and carrying over to 403. This is from the final rule preamble, and there's a comparable discussion in the proposed rule. And what the administrator does is discuss how he looked at the overall pattern of results through all the short-term studies, including those that had 24-hour 98th percentile values well above 35, down to the ones that were in the range from 35 to 30, and then the few studies that were available below 30.
Are you talking starting on the last full paragraph on 402? Is that what you're talking?
Yes, the last full paragraph on 402, continuing through the second column in 403. And the particular discussion of studies in the range of 35 to 30, including that Phoenix study, is the last paragraph in the first column of 403. That's where the administrator cites Marr et al., which is the Phoenix study, but he also cites four other studies with 98th percentile values in the same range and shows that the results were mixed in that group. The studies in Santa Clara County and the third study that we've mentioned in this group were part of the discussion above. Fairley is the Santa Clara County study, and you can see that cited at the very top of 403 column one. Mm-hmm. And the Canadian eight city study is at the very bottom of 402 column three. So each of these studies was discussed at length, both initially and then specifically in response to KSAC's focus on those studies.
And that was in the context of setting an annual or in the context of setting the daily?
Well, this actually is the discussion of where to set the daily standard, but there is
what
also...
What I was asking is where they were discussed with respect to setting the annual.
They were also discussed in, or KSAC's comments on these studies were also discussed in 408 to 409 of the joint appendix. And if you look at the paragraph that starts in the bottom half of 408 column 2, you get, they refer to the fact KSAC considered evidence from specific short-term exposure studies as part of the basis for its recommendation for a lower annual standard, pointing to studies indicating that effects from short-term exposure of PM2.5 persist in cities with annual concentrations below the current standard. And the administrator goes on to discuss specifically why he did not find these studies a basis for changing the annual and why he was...
Where's the reason why, other than the fact that he's not going to do it?
He says the administrator recognizes that the agency used short-term exposure studies in the last review as the primary basis for setting the level of a generally controlling annual standard, but he notes that a public health policy choice was made, that choice was made at the time primarily because the short-term exposure studies were the strongest evidence available.
Right. Well, that seems like a good argument to not look at them so much as much as the others, but not an argument to not look at them at all. That's what I was...
Goes on to say, in this review, the bodies of evidence for both short and long-term exposures have been substantially extended and strengthened, such that each PM2.5 standard can appropriately be evaluated based on the most directly relevant body of studies and can be...
So there is no actual addressing of those studies. It's just that I've got enough long-term studies, and so I'm going to look at that, and I've got enough short-term studies, and I'm going to look at
that. And I think that was a scientifically valid approach to take. In the joint appendix, and we've cited in our brief evidence that there are different effects associated to some extent with long-term exposure. There are potentially different mechanisms of causation associated with long-term exposure. And even in the prior review, when picking the 2.5 and 10 indicators, there was already discussion even at that time of the fact that those indicators were useful in part because they matched the periods of exposure that the epidemiologic evidence looked at, short-term and long-term. The problem was, at the time, there wasn't a good enough evidentiary basis to use each study independently. In this review, there was a better evidentiary basis, and therefore there was a reason to use a different approach than in 1997.
Okay, thank you.
If I can turn to the Gouderman study, Southern California study that was mentioned, and also the 24 cities study. I'd like to point out that the 24 cities study had been evaluated in the prior rulemaking, and the administrator had at that time, or the staff at that time, had determined that it was difficult to interpret that study as supporting the need for protection below 15. And in fact, what they said in 97 was that it was more likely to be consistent with a finding that effects occur above 15 than below. And I can refer you to uh, 238 of the joint appendix for that finding. There was nothing, there's certainly nothing in the record to suggest that this study had been, should have been analyzed differently in this review, and it was therefore reasonable for the administrator to conclude that the study remained consistent with the conclusion that 15 constitutes an adequate margin of safety.
Now, that's the 97 rule.
But my point was simply that it had already been evaluated once and determined to be, and it was determined at the time that the data appeared more likely to show effects above 15 than below. Now here, the analysis was a bit more conservative than that, that it was unclear as to whether they showed any effects below 15. But the bottom line is, if that study is to be considered in conjunction with Gouderman, and it was, and ALA argues that it should, it certainly doesn't call into question the conclusion that overall, considering the evidence as a whole, the long-term study supported a finding that 15 gave an adequate margin of safety. In addition to that, the reasons the administrator gave for giving less weight to Gouderman than to ACS and mortalities were certainly plausible and valid reasons. ACS and six cities were both, and 24 cities were all multi-city studies. ACF, for example, if you look at the information about it in Joint Appendix 4319, covered 1.2 million subjects from every state, the district, and Puerto Rico. Six cities, described at 4387 in the Joint Appendix, covered cities in the Northeast, South, and Midwest. Both studies were demonstrably robust in terms of continuing to show statistically significant results after.
They show regional differences of any significance.
They showed, well, the studies were subject to a number of tests to determine if particular variables were affecting the results, whether that was personal health characteristics of particular subjects in the studies, whether it was potentially confounding air pollutants, which obviously differ from place to place. And after going through that battery of tests.
They may differ, but did the outcomes differ? Now, the administrator says, well, I'm not going to rely on that study for a national standard. It's based on one locale. Well, then the premise, the implicit premise is that that these effects may vary significantly from one place to another. You've got studies of as many as 24 cities. Do they show that?
I wouldn't be able to tell you without looking back directly at the record precisely what the effects, what effects may have been shown for a particular city. But I can tell you that certainly after exhaustive reanalysis, the conclusion was these constituted the strongest evidence for finding associations of long-term exposure with health effects.
And that's 24 cities do.
No, I'm talking about the particularly ACS and the six city studies. Gouderman was, as we discussed, a single study in a single area identifying a newly observed effect with a long-term mean at the annual level, not below. And the results were not consistent because there was a significant positive association with effects in one cohort of children, but not in a follow-up cohort. And that's supported at Joint Appendix 406 and Joint Appendix 1731. 406 is the administrator's observation that statistically significant associations were not consistently reported. 1731 is the actual summary of the study itself. The criteria, if you look at the criteria for evaluating epidemiologic evidence as described in the criteria document, it refers to a consistent pattern of findings in different persons, places, and times. And the court has long recognized, for example, in the opinion in ATA 1, rejecting a challenge to epidemiologic evidence, that part of what the administrator has always done is to look at whether the pattern of results holds up when you look at different parts of the country, different mixes of air pollutants, precisely because you want to, as much as possible, to be able to rule out confounders. So again, these were valid scientific reasons the administrator gave for giving less weight to this study. And
I'm sorry, to which
giving less weight to the Gouderman study in relation to the ACS and six city studies in particular. If I, I'd like to point out too that this is in line in terms of the level of precaution.
His critique of the 24 city study in this regard, or was it another one, was that it was dealt with one time.
It was, I don't know if every effect evaluated was cross, was a point in time, but to the extent that it looked at diminution in lung function, it was looking at a point in time. It was a cross-sectional study.
Right.
It was not.
Epidemiological evidence by its nature is not a point.
Generally, no. You're looking at changes over time. You're looking at an association over time. I see that I'm over my time. If I can briefly address the secondary standards.
Questions on the secondary standards? We'll go ahead. Take a minute.
Okay. Just two quick points about the secondary standard. Well, three quick points, actually. One is when counsel has referred to whether there is any additional protection, we certainly know there's additional protection of visibility under the revised suite of primary standards than under the 1997 primary standards, because we know that a substantial number of areas will not meet these revised standards and will therefore require an improvement in air quality. The staff found that clear correlations exist between 24-hour average PM2.5 concentrations and reconstructed light extinction, which is directly related to visual range. That's in staff paper, Joint Appendix 2013. So if there is a clear correlation, then it is certainly reasonable to assume that if a number of areas are going to have to improve their air quality to meet the revised standards, then they will also improve visibility. Second point, with regard to KSAC, I'd just like to be clear, there was a mention of KSAC having found that relying on the revised primary standards to control for visibility effects will result in continuing degradation. As best I understand that paraphrase, that is a paraphrase of a letter that KSAC sent in September 2006.
This is the one that has numerical coincidence in it.
Well, their comments during the rulemaking were that there was a numerical coincidence. And their second comment in their final letter during the rulemaking was that using the primary standards would introduce error and uncertainty. That is how they put it, would introduce error and uncertainty. But they did not go so far as to suggest that it would allow substantial continued degradation. They made that statement after the rule was signed, and that means that letter was not before the administrator, is not part of the record, and not part of the record for judicial review.
This goes to the, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is it in our JA?
It's submitted as part of the JA, but we pointed out in our brief that that letter is post-record, and we asked that the court disregard references to it. Several references to it were made.
What's the page that you want us to disregard?
Page, I guess I shot myself in the foot with that point, but it's 3284. I guess my point is the statute's very clear on what's in the record and what's not. This letter was signed after the final rule was signed. There's no question that the administrator not only didn't have it, but couldn't consider it, and therefore this court should not either.
Does the administrator have any measure himself as to visibility, as to how to measure visibility?
He doesn't. Certainly, based on this record, there is only, I guess you could say the evidence is fairly rough. There is no precise quantification of exactly what the improvement in protection is over the previous set of standards. This court has not, in previous cases, required that there be a precise calculation of exactly
precise
how much
or not. Is it
protection.
Does the administrator look at these pictures and say they look the same to me, or does he just say there's no evidence, there's no way to determine visibility, and I'm going to
consider it,
or what?
We know a couple of things. We know that, again, that a number of areas will have to improve their air quality. We also know that under the prior set of standards,
that rule would suggest whenever you lower the health standard, you're going to take care of the visibility standard. But that doesn't tell us whether there's a different test for visibility than for health.
Well, we also know that in order to comply with the 24-hour standard, 98% of the daily concentration levels are going to have to be below 35.
So then
and that means they'll have to be below the range where the staff found that scenic views are significantly obscured.
So that argument's agree. So the administrator agrees that lowering the thresholds improves visibility. Is that right?
Certainly the administrator agreed that the evidence made it clear that the prior standards needed to be adjusted, in part because having a daily level of 65 was going to allow a number of very poor visibility days, particularly in the West.
And how did he measure visibility?
Well,
all I see here is criticisms of other people's measures of visibility, but to say what you just said, means the administrator must have some idea about how to measure visibility.
Well, there's a difference between, I mean, certainly the administrator considered the evidence, the photographic evidence and valuation evidence, and he thought that that was a sufficient basis not to leave the set the level of welfare protection unchanged from 1997. But then the next question was, if we know we're going to achieve improvement in welfare protection with this set of primary standards, do we know enough to pick some additional degree of protection than that provided by the primary standards, and to do it using a different averaging time?
I'm just a little confused. When you say that he thought they shouldn't leave it where it was, all you mean is that he set it where the primary standards were.
Right.
The new primary standards.
He found that 35 and 65 would not have provided adequate.
What if he didn't? What if he had done nothing? If he lowered the primary standard but left the secondary standard alone, would that make any difference in the way states respond?
Well,
they'd still have to go to the primary standard anyway, right?
Well, you're right. They would still have to comply with the primary
standard. So he's really done nothing by saying that I'm going to match it to the new primary standard.
Well, he hasn't set a distinct standard, and he hasn't picked a different averaging time, form, et cetera. In part
he hasn't
because
actually done evidence. Anything with respect to visibility that the primary standard wouldn't accomplish.
He's addressed visibility and health effects through revising the primary standards. I would agree with that.
But
to say that he's done nothing about visibility is not true, because we know that revising the primary standards will lead to some improved visibility.
So then he agrees that the reduction will lead to improved visibility. So how does he decide that simply setting it where the health standard, the safety standard is sufficient with respect to visibility? How does he know that?
Well, I think
happens to coincide.
Well, he referenced the fact in the preamble explanation that a roughly comparable number of areas were going, and a roughly comparable population in terms of percentage, were going to be in areas that would experience better air quality because of the need to comply and meet the revised standards. So in that sense, the amount of protection provided geographically overall is comparable to that provided by the range of proposed sub-daily standards, even if we don't know precisely if it's the exact same counties versus some differences. And it was comparable not only nationwide,
using the county argument. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that was part of the basis that the administrator gave.
Because
in
the two preamble. Charts, by listing the two charts, is that what
Yes, there were two charts that looked at which.
But there was the analysis that you have, which is the difference between the 95th and the 92nd and the 98th, that's not anywhere in the Federal Register, is it? The effort to compare the KSAC suggestion of the four-hour standard.
No, there's discussion in the Federal Register of the fact that there was a comparable level of...
Could you find that?
Sure. Specifically in Joint Appendix 441, the bottom half of the first column into the second column, or the bottom of the first column into the second column.
Bottom of the first into the second?
Yes.
Comparing the extent to which?
Yes, comparing the extent to which the proposed suite of primary standards would require areas to improve visual air quality.
Yeah.
And shows that the administrator looked at an analysis of the areas not likely to meet the alternative secondary standard. He cites two tables, and the two tables he's citing, one of them is a reference to counties and percentage of counties and percentage of population that will likely exceed and therefore need to improve air quality to attain the revised primary standards. And the other table is making that same look with regard to the sub-daily standards that the staff recommended.
Right, and these are the tables where we don't know whether the monitors are the same in the same place or not.
We don't know whether they're in the same counties. We do, though, see a pretty consistent comparison in the various regions of the country in terms of, you know, out west it's roughly the same percentage. In the upper Midwest, it's roughly the same percentage, et cetera, when you look at the two tables. If I may briefly conclude.
The administrator's attitude here is he doesn't have to quantify changes in visibility in a way that sets a standard, a quantified standard. At all.
This court has consistently held that the administrator is not required to quantify precisely the acceptable risk or the acceptable effects. Now, that said, to the extent the evidence allows him to analyze it, certainly the administrator will look at it, and he considered it here, but he was he recognized its limitations.
You did argue, didn't you, that this point was waived?
In terms of whether the specific points that ALA has argued about why these two tables are not comparable, those were not presented in the rulemaking. The CASAC did make the point that it described this as a numerical coincidence and said that it's not demonstrating any relationship between health and visibility. The administrator agreed that this doesn't, I'm not making this finding, the administrator said, based on the idea that there is a relationship between health and visibility. However,
there's a relationship between health standards and
right.
Can I just back up on this last point? This is also the point to which CASAC filed this late comment, is that right?
That's one of the items they addressed in that late comment.
So when you say that the ALA didn't respond or didn't say that this analysis doesn't really show equivalence, when would have the first time been for them to have done that?
Well,
then it's an attack on the chart. When would they have been able to attack the chart? Only after the notice was issued, right? Because they wouldn't have any idea of knowing, no way of knowing that the agency would rely on these two charts until the rule was issued, right?
Well, it certainly could have. They knew in the based on the proposed rule that the administrator was proposing to set secondary standards equivalent to the primary standards.
Right, and they challenged that, and CASAC had a different standard. It's only in the final rule itself in which the administrator tries to explain why what he's doing is the same as what CASAC is doing. So I'm not sure of how can that be a waiver if the argument isn't made until the final rule.
Well,
the specific thing they want to respond to, which is that these charts do not use the same monitors. How could they have possibly known that until you put the charts out?
Well,
not you personally.
I understand. Two things about that. One is, even in its final letter, CASAC still doesn't make these particular criticisms that they are making. CASAC certainly argues strenuously in its post-record letter that relying on the primary standards to control visibility will result in continued degradation. But it doesn't make it doesn't present this specific.
I'm trying to figure out the legal argument about waiver. So
well, I guess
if your legal argument about waiver is they didn't raise it before, and in fact the only time it's presented is in the final rule, that either that's a pretty weak argument about waiver, or it suggests, well, then we should look at post-final rule filings, one of which is CASAC's.
Well, the answer to that is, assuming you're right that this was not apparent as a part of the basis until the final rule, then they should have moved for reconsideration based on CASAC's comment, or based on their own.
We should at least be able to consider CASAC's comment. If you agree that if you think that the appropriate thing to do is move for reconsideration, I don't think we've ever said that with respect to the waiver of a rule, have we? Have we ever said that a commenter has to move for reconsideration of a final rule?
Or challenge this part of the decision on procedural grounds.
Well, the procedural ground is failure to make an explanation that makes sense. That's their argument. And your argument is, well, they didn't make that point, and their argument is you didn't make that argument until too late. Now, there are some statutes that require petitions for reconsideration. This is not one of them.
Well, it does define, though, clearly what's in the record before the administrator as those materials submitted during the rulemaking and not afterward, or to the extent that a petition for reconsideration is filed.
I guess I'm asking this. Are there any cases about waiver where we've said that a party has waived by not filing a petition for reconsideration to reconsider something that wasn't apparent until the final rule?
I mean,
we do that in FERC cases or FCC cases because the statute says you have to do it by petition for reconsideration. But this statute doesn't say that.
I'm almost certain that in the Mossville Environmental Action Now opinion, the court, well, there certainly was a part of the challenge in that case that was decided on waiver grounds. And I'm pretty sure in the opinion there, the court likely referred to the fact that no request for reconsideration was made. Mossville Environmental Action Now versus EPA.
Is that cited in the briefs? Just so I don't have to fight. Sorry.
The point is, I'm getting a little off track. This is a 307D rule. 307D specifically defines what's before the administrator. It doesn't leave any exception. I can refer you to the precise statutory provisions.
No, I understand what's in the record and what's not, but that's your answer to why the CASAC rebuttal doesn't count.
Yes.
But what I'm asking is, why does your waiver argument count?
I would say for the same.
Well, 307D doesn't say anything.
Well, I guess the point is that the considerations that they are now bringing to bear were not before the administrator at the time of the rulemaking.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to hold up on the rebuttals just for one moment until Judge Ginsburg comes back. So you're going to give us some back, or how are you going to do that?
Right. I want to take a minute and reply as opposed to repeat.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank
you. I'm most interested in the disregarding of the short-term studies.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd make a point about relevance, and that is under this court's precedent, EPA's required to consider all relevant studies revealed in the record. The NRDC versus EPA case that we cite in our opening brief is...
I got that, but they say they did consider it. Then, for good reason, they decided not to consider it. And I asked, well, it looked like you're only considering it with respect short-term to short-term. And they said, no, we considered it with respect to long-term, but we decided it wasn't relevant to that. Certainly, if it isn't relevant to that, they don't have to consider it. So what's the answer to that?
Well, Your Honor, they did not consider the average annual concentration levels in determining the adequate margin of safety for the annual standard. The short-term studies that showed positive association between exposure to PM2.5 and levels below 15, those three studies that we describe in our brief, they did not consider those in setting the annual standard. Despite the fact, in the last NAAQS review, they considered short-term exposure studies as the primary basis of coming up with that standard of 15. They based the standard on both short-term exposure studies and long-term exposure studies, setting the level below the average annual concentrations in those studies combined. Here, had they done that, the administrator could not have concluded that 15 provided an adequate margin of safety. And why does that matter? It matters for the reasons that Mr. Court was saying, and that is EPA has not shown that a 24-hour standard lowered to 35 is going to address risks in those cities that have relatively high annual concentrations but little daily variation. So it's not just an issue of this court's precedent in terms of EPA needing to consider everything that's relevant, but it also has direct meaning or direct bearing on the issue of whether 15 is an adequate margin of safety. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Court.
Okay, let me first clarify some record citation issues. First, on the valuation studies that you asked for, I'd refer the court to JA 1947 to 51. And it's an extended discussion. I can't even try to summarize it here, but it's more than just surveys. It's a variety of valuation studies in there.
This is on the visibility?
On the visibility.
Yeah, so. I looked at that actually after our colloquy. And it seemed that references made to other studies, but that the staff's conclusions seemed to be based on the survey perceptions and attitudes, I think they calls it.
I didn't read the staff report that way. I think what they said is that all of these studies, the valuation studies, the photographic evidence, their review of local standards, all tended to converge on the same conclusion, which is that there is a level of visibility that they can say is adequate in urban areas, which is 25 to 35 kilometers. And then backing from that, they were able to say, we can set a 4 or 8 hour limit at this level and achieve that level of visibility in all urban areas.
I think it was, wasn't it 40 to 60 kilometers?
I think ultimately they did soften it and say, but I think they said all the studies sort of point to this 25 to 35 kilometer target.
So even if they can't put a dollar value on it, they know it when they can't see it.
the other record point I wanted to clear up, there was some confusion on the comparability of the tables. CASAC did raise that during the rulemaking. It was in again JA 3273.
Look at 348.
Which volume is it?
First volume. This is the proposed rulemaking document.
Right.
I think this is what you're talking about. In the second, the middle column, 348. Mm-hmm. Second, the first full sentence.
Right. Yeah. No, there's no dispute that they raised this table, this comparability argument in the proposal, and CASAC said that comparison doesn't tell you anything.
Right, but the question on the table that Judge Garland put on the table was whether CASAC had, before the final rule,
yes,
an opportunity
yes.
to address
and,
this.
And I want to clear up that they did,
that would have been an easier answer.
Right.
But say again, 3273.
So that's their letter, their comment in 3273. It's their, the third, bullet number three. And they say the cited comparability between percentages of counties not likely to meet a lenient sub-daily standard and the proposed 24-hour primary standard is a numerical coincidence.
That's CASAC.
That's CASAC. And then in the disputed letter that...
Again, is there anything beyond saying these are apples and oranges, which is maybe inquiry notice, but not a notice of what the problem is?
There's nothing more. But we think that is the point, that EPA... by relying on this comparison of tables, has not made the case. And that was exactly what CASAC was saying. So, and I would like to just address two other points that respondents raised. I think that your questions suggest that you understand this ABT study. But again, as you're pointing out, there are these other limits. I mean, if they're relying on the fact that, PM10 standard with an annual limit and the NOx and the SOx and all these other limits led to proportional shifting of the concentrations, I don't think that supports their claim that by reducing a peak limit, they're going to get that same response. But more fundamentally...
They just don't know. I mean, they don't know.
Right.
Over a certain range, it seems to have happened, right? If you concede that the movements were proportionate.
Right.
Okay, so they say over a certain range it seems to have happened. Over the next range, who knows? They say it's likely, but that's about it.
Yeah, but fundamentally we're dealing with a standard here that says you have to reduce the worst 2% of days. So why is there any reason to think that shaving off those worst days is going to lead to a reduction across the board? And
only because they think it did in the past.
But the standards in the past weren't similar peak limits. But what I wanted to do.
I was saying it was over a different range where that seems to have occurred.
Yeah, different range, different pollutants, different averaging time. But I wanted to reemphasize sort of the more fundamental point, which is that even if it's true, even if there is a shift, EPA still needs to make a demonstration that that shift is going to lead to day-to-day levels that are safe. I mean, that's a statutory requirement, and they've never done that. And moreover, we have raised, CASAC has raised the point that there are areas that will do nothing to meet a lower peak limit because they already meet that lower peak limit, and those areas continue to suffer short-term health effects. And finally, I wanted to address the mixed results of the peak studies, because I think this kind of sums up the disconnect that's going on in the analysis, because EPA looks at the difference in peak levels in these cities and says, well, in some cities we saw a problem when the peak level was below 35, and in some cities we didn't. But EPA has said itself that it's not about peak exposures. The problem is in the day-to-day exposure levels, and EPA never looks within those studies to say, well, what are those day-to-day exposure levels? And more fundamentally, it shouldn't depend on what kind of strategy the states pick in order to meet the standards. The standards should assure that public health will be protected no matter what the states do, whether they choose to shave off only the worst days or choose to regulate the sources that pollute on a day-to-day basis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Court. Now we know the difference between a New York minute and a Washington minute.
Issue 2, industry petitioners' issues related to coarse particle standards. For the industry petitioners, Ms. Kennedy and Mr. Schwartz. For the EPA, Mr. Rave.
May it please the court. I'm Denise Kennedy, representing the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. EPA found there was no evidence of adverse health effects from rural coarse PM. EPA overstepped its bounds when it set a NAAQS without evidence of adverse health effects. EPA's job is to make distinctions, to regulate when appropriate, and to abstain from regulation when not appropriate. It was not appropriate for EPA to set a NAAQS for rural coarse PM for three key reasons. First, EPA ignored its own record that found critical distinctions between urban and rural coarse PM. Two, EPA's NAAQS for rural coarse PM is more than necessary to protect the public health. Three, EPA's decision to ignore its own findings and set a standard for rural type coarse PM anyway will have real adverse impacts. I will discuss each of these points in turn. First, EPA ignored its own record that found critical distinctions between urban and rural coarse PM. This court in Alabama Power authorized EPA to exclude from the particulate matter standard particulates of a size or composition determined not to cause substantial public health concerns. This is just what EPA proposed to do here in excluding rural coarse PM from the NAAQS. However, EPA ignored its own findings and conclusions in the final rule and those of its health advisors and set a NAAQS for rural coarse PM where there's simply no evidence of public health risk from ambient levels. This is not a matter of us disagreeing with EPA's interpretation of the evidence. EPA itself found that, quote, the limited and inconclusive evidence does not support regulation of particles typically found in non-urban areas. CASAC said rural coarse PM should not be included in the NAAQS because it is largely comprised of windblown soil or products of agricultural operations for which there is either no or limited evidence of health issues. EPA's brief noted that the evidence of health effects occupational exposures.
Excuse me, did CASAC suggest some means of distinguishing among these?
Well, CASAC talked about the fact that in rural areas, the coarse particulate matter is comprised largely of windblown dust, agriculture operations, and that's the most significant component of the health mass that you see in rural areas. And in urban areas, there was a very small indicator, and even CASAC had concerns with whether there was enough evidence to set a NAAQS for urban coarse PM, but concluded ultimately that there was. But the condition on which it agreed that urban coarse PM could be regulated was that EPA would need to find a way to exclude from that NAAQS the coarse particulate matter for which there was even some evidence that it did not cause health effects, much less an absence of evidence.
Did the CASAC, though, suggest a way of doing that?
CASAC left that to EPA for its implementation. CASAC was reviewing the health evidence and advising EPA on the level to which it found health effects or concerns that EPA should regulate, but it was up to EPA to determine once CASAC advised it, EPA staff determined and analyzed the health evidence, then it's up to EPA to determine how to implement the CASAC advice.
Okay. So there was this Coachella study, the OSPR
right,
study,
right.
Which you criticize as not really being rural, but which the agency thinks is sufficiently rural. So it's not as if there's no study. There were the miners, the occupational health studies, which you criticize, but which there are studies. There's the data about the size of the coarse, whether it's in a rural or in a non-rural situation, being it capable of reaching the lungs. There's the data about coarse, whether it's rural or not rural, being susceptible to being adhered to by either toxic material or to fine. So that's it doesn't have the sort of quantitative mechanisms that the some studies may have, but it's not that there's no evidence, is there?
Well, I think if we look at each of those pieces of evidence that Your Honor mentioned, the OSHA standard is 5,000 micrograms, more than 30 times higher than the number that EPA determined here. And we've never said that there are no health effects from rural coarse PM, but we've said that there are no health effects at ambient levels. And 5,000 micrograms is not what we would consider an ambient level. The OSTRO study, when it's carefully looked at, EPA, there was data missing for the necessary PM2.5 data was missing for 7.5 years, and that's how EPA determines what the coarse particulate matter level is. And the 2.5 years where there was actually where the real PM2.5 data was measured, there was no evidence of a statistical association with the PM10 minus 2.5 data. It was the 7.5 years when it was missing, and EPA applied a regression analysis that that's been frequently criticized as far as how they substituted for the missing PM2.5 data years.
Is that, is that the fact that's been criticized? We're not exactly in the business here of evaluating how
no, but EPA itself has criticized that study.
But I mean, they did rely on the study in the end.
Well, they rely on it in their brief, but if you look at the proposed rule, beginning at the bottom of page 2671 and going over to the top of page 2672, there's an extensive analysis by EPA of the available health studies, and EPA fundamentally discounts the OSTRO study, partly because of this missing PM2.5 data, the fact that the period when there was the real PM2.5 data, when they were actually able to derive an accurate or more accurate estimate of PM10 minus 2.5, found no statistical association. And this is EPA's own findings. This is not us trying to dig into the health studies and disagree with the scientists and experts here. The second key reason for this court and that we believe it was inappropriate for EPA to set a NAAQS for rural coarse PM is that the resulting rural coarse PM NAAQS is more than necessary to protect the public health. EPA created a new standard for setting a NAAQS here. It found that its margin of safety entirely replaces the need for any public health evidence. EPA justifies this on the grounds that someday there may be a study that may show adverse health effects from rural coarse PM. So to be safe, we should just go ahead and regulate the pollutant now as if that future study had already occurred. The U.S. Supreme Court in Whitman held EPA to a higher standard. It found that EPA must set a NAAQS that is sufficient but no more than necessary to protect the public health. Clearly, a NAAQS that includes particulate matter for which there is no evidence of public health risk is more than necessary. EPA forgets that the NAAQS setting process is an evolution. Over time, as health evidence is developed, EPA continues to review the health evidence and determine whether there is an adequate risk to public health to justify regulation. Just as in 1997, EPA set a standard of 65 for PM2.5, and in 2006 reduced that standard to 35. EPA acts as if it does not now set a NAAQS for rural coarse PM, it will never be able to do so. In fact, EPA is now planning to do the necessary studies to determine whether or not rural coarse PM has adverse health effects. The next review of the NAAQS can consider these studies. To regulate rural coarse PM in the meantime is to engage in crystal ball speculation. Third important reason, EPA's decision to ignore its own findings and set a standard for rural coarse PM anyway will have real adverse impacts. Counties in Arizona, in order to ensure that operations in the area meet the NAAQS, and it's important to remember here that NAAQS are absolute. All operations must meet the NAAQS in an area. There's no exception for impossibility of controls to meet the standard. Operations can be curtailed or shut down if they can't meet the NAAQS. In Arizona, the counties proposed no-tilling days in which farms would not be able to farm on those days. This agriculture tilling generates the very dust that KSAC found to be of low toxicity. This is, if this court does not find that EPA must have an adequate health standard for a NAAQS, entire areas of our rural economy will be put at risk. In contrast to EPA's conclusion that its decision to set a NAAQS for rural coarse is the cautious approach, just the opposite may be the case. In efforts to control all coarse, efforts to control urban cores may be diluted and may not focus on the cores PM of concern.
Ms. Kennedy, I think we have your argument
from
the brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, my name is Richard Schwartz. I'm representing the American Farm Bureau Federation and the National Pork Producers Council. And this morning, I'm going to talk about EPA's failure to set a requisite level for PM cores. And this level that they've actually set for PM cores is a variable level, and it's one that's never been approved by this court. It used the same number in 1987. When it set a level for all particulate matter less than 10 microns. Then in 1997, it took the same number and applied it as a basis for regulating coarse particulate matter, and this court vacated that standard because it was confounded by PM fine. And it vacated it without ever looking at the level that was set because it essentially vacated it before the level came up. What EPA has done in this round is set a level for PM cores that is absolutely identical to the one that the court vacated in 1997. And the problem, among the things that are key about this, is that the level isn't 150 for PM cores. The level is 150 minus the amount of PM fine in the air. And the record shows that that varies daily. It varies from area to area. And so there is no single level for PM cores that the agency has set. And this court has never approved that the level, whatever level it is, previously, prior to the adoption of this final rule, not for the purpose of regulating PM cores. Now, EPA's own findings show that this level is not requisite for non-urban areas. One thing to keep in mind is that coarse levels are local because coarse doesn't travel as far as fine particulate matter. And so you know the sources of PM coarse much better than PM fine. In urban areas, EPA found that the sources are mostly traffic driving on unpaved roads. And this is not the combustion part of it, but simply the aspect of the traffic traveling there. Also industrial sources and construction sources. And the evidence, EPA concluded that the evidence showed that, in its view, targeted protection was warranted with respect to urban PM cores, but that the limited and inconclusive evidence didn't support the same conclusion with respect to non-urban PM cores. But the key point here is that EPA found that urban and non-urban cores were different, and that difference was relevant to the health effects that could be found with respect to the two different kinds of coarse particulate matter. Now, what followed from that was EPA's conclusion that you can't generalize from studies in urban areas about the effect of non-urban cores and apply those results to other areas. And EPA made that finding not just in the proposed rule, but in the final rule. What followed from that was EPA's admission that the same coarse limit cannot be requisite for both urban areas and non-urban areas. And in fact, that applying the Whitman test, EPA said, it acknowledged that if a level was appropriate for urban areas, it would be more stringent than necessary for non-urban areas, and that would violate the Whitman test. And we quoted from that statement on page 25 of our brief. So what EPA did flies in the face of these findings. What EPA did was set the same limit for urban and non-urban areas, and it based that limit on urban studies, which EPA acknowledges at page 117 of its brief. For these reasons, we believe that the level set by EPA is clearly inappropriate for non-urban areas and should be vacated by this court. And we also think that the level has not been shown to be requisite for any area because of the variability. The actual limit will vary from day to day and from location to location, depending on the amount of fine particulate matter in the air. Our brief showed in one example how large this variation can be. It's a significant one. And the record does not show that EPA did any analysis of which, if any, of these variable levels actually would be requisite. And again, for this reason, different from urban and non-urban, but nonetheless, this similarly the lack of analysis, EPA's level was not justified as requisite as and meeting the Whitman test. I'd like to also mention something about the PM10 indicator that this court had vacated, that EPA readopted for this purpose, because it plays into the issue about the urban-non-urban distinction. EPA actually relied on the urban-non-urban distinction as a justification for readopting the vacated limit. It is indeed confounding, and EPA said that essentially this confounding limit here is compensating because it used the word typically. Typically, EPA said, fine particulate matter is higher in urban areas than in other places, and so that'll compensate for the difference in toxicity. The problem is that the record does not support the conclusion that there will be such compensation. What the record shows is simply variability. Fine levels vary in urban areas. Fine levels vary in non-urban areas. There was no attempt to show any relationship between the differential and the difference in the health evidence. And so there's simply no analysis and nothing in the record that supports the conclusion that this vacated standard is fine now because sometimes the levels of fine particulate matter is higher in urban areas than in other areas. One other point that I would like to make about the use of precedent here and then the application of law, I think the key question that arises is what difference does the Whitman case make? I mean, the Whitman case simply said that the Clean Air Act is not an unconstitutional delegation, an unlawful delegation of executive power. And so you could say that all of the precedent beforehand should simply be applied in the same way. But what Whitman did was establish the meaning of the word requisite and clarify that the word requisite means not more stringent than necessary, in addition to being not too loose. Whitman is about the lower bound for a national ambient air quality standard. It's a canon of statutory construction that courts must give effect to all words of a statute to the extent that that's possible. And so what you conclude is that the reliance on a margin of safety, and in this case EPA's reliance on what it calls caution, cannot lawfully override the duty to establish an act that is requisite at a level that is requisite. And so for these reasons, we believe that certainly for non-urban areas and additionally for all areas, EPA simply failed to meet its burden of establishing that this NAAQS is requisite for PM course. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz.
Sure.
Can I just ask on that last point? Is this the same argument that was made in ATA 3 about Whitman, that it's not requisite because there's not a specific safe level on which the court rejected, saying EPA has no obligation either to identify an accurate safe level of pollutant or to quantify precisely the pollutant's risks prior to setting the primary NAAQS?
Yeah, ATA 3 was about accuracy and about how you interpret studies of acknowledged health effects. Here we have a situation where there's simply no evidence with respect to a proper level in non-urban areas. And in fact, what we have is a level in other areas other than urban that flies in the face of EPA's own findings concerning the application of Whitman.
I'm specifically asking about this difference about whether the margin of safety there, and there's a conflict with this requisite standard. It seems like on that question we said that EPA has to err on the side of caution, notwithstanding, that is, in deciding what is requisite that includes, as the statute says, the necessary margin.
Yes, but erring on the side of caution can't override the duty to find a requisite level. It's something that has to be balanced. And what we're saying here is that you can't ignore the obligation to set a requisite level, which means that EPA has an obligation to find to show record support and analysis for the level that it finds. In ATA 3, I think a lot of the concern was that what the petitioners did was take sort of snippets of EPA statements and take them out of context. And this court rejected those, and in doing so, it repeated some of the law that you're referring to. But factually, the case is much, much different from the one we're presenting here.
Thank you. Mr. Rafe.
Good morning, Your Honor. Norman Rave from the Department of Justice, representing EPA, and I'd like to introduce at council table Stephen Silverman from EPA's Office of General Counsel. Let me start with the first point that Ms. Kennedy made, which is their assertion that EPA found that there is no risk from non-urban coarse particles. And as I think Judge Garland was pointing out in the question he was asking, contrary is the case. EPA did find that it had serious reasons to believe that there is a risk posed by non-urban coarse particles. The evidence is exactly the types of evidence that Judge Garland was talking about, the dosimetric evidence that particles can be absorbed deeply into the lungs, the fact that there are the same types of contaminants, including fungi, pollen, endotoxins, the types of contaminants including motor vehicle emissions, industrial activities, all of which take place in non-urban areas. And in addition, the Coachella Valley study that Judge Garland also raised. It is simply not true, as Ms. Kennedy alleged, that EPA found that the study was unreliable. First of all, the section of the proposed preamble that she cited to was not articulating EPA's view, but was in fact presenting alternative views that EPA was summarized. At the very bottom of Federal Register, this is page 337 in the joint appendix, and it's 71 Federal Register 2670, the first column at the very bottom, it says, another view that reflects a more cautious or restrained approach. And then the next several pages of the Federal Register, including the portions cited by Ms. Kennedy, cite that alternative view, which includes the criticisms of the Ostro study. EPA itself, in the final rule, determined that the Ostro study was at least indicative that there is a potential problem from non-urban coarse particles. That's at 71 Federal Register 61190-91, which is at 424 to 425 of the joint appendix. And CASAC also relied on the Ostro study, the Coachella Valley study, in at JA 3092, citing it as evidence that there may be some health risk posed by non-urban particles. Again, the study was CASAC's primary purpose is to vet the science, to decide what's reliable science and what the agency should consider, and it relied on the Ostro study. So in all of this evidence taken together, the evidence that particles are contaminated with the same materials, the actual epidemiological study of Mostro showing that particles of non-urban origin are associated with mortality, all led EPA to the conclusion that there is a risk posed by non-urban particles. Moreover, EPA determined, and I think this was the question the issue Judge Ginsburg related to in your question about whether CASAC said how we could tell them apart. Ultimately, EPA decided that it couldn't, that the particles don't fall into a bright line category between urban particles that pose a risk and non-urban particles that don't. They interact as a broad mix of particles. They fall along a continuum. And EPA was not able to define a criterion that would say these particles pose a risk and these particles don't.
So there were no types of particles that were found to pose no risk?
That's correct, Your Honor. There is certainly the KSEX recommendation.
Including dust and all that.
That's correct, Your Honor, because that's largely what the Ostro study was dust being blown in from the desert into to Ostro. There are toxicology studies, some of which suggest that there may be some risk posed by dust. The notion that there is less risk in non-urban areas comes from two things. One, the fact that there simply are very few epidemiological studies conducted there. Epidemiological studies, because we're looking at relatively small effects, have to look at large populations, have to be conducted over a fairly lengthy period of time. And the data to do that kind of analysis exists in urban areas where there are large populations that you can look for these small trends that you have to, looking at the deaths that are caused by changes in particulate level, and you have to sort that out from all the other things that contribute to people dying. And to see that effect, you need a large population. So the strength of the evidence is certainly greater in urban areas. And there is some evidence.
Your point on this precise issue must be only that those studies have not been done. Isn't
that's
that
correct,
right?
Your Honor.
They're not there.
They're not there.
Whether they could be done is a different
story. It's a different story, but they're not there. I guess I'm simply illustrating why
I have some doubts about the claim that they defy epidemiological treatment, because we have data on rural counties throughout the nation which could be aggregated. But the fact is, apparently, they haven't been done.
It has not been done.
Okay. So I may be right or wrong, but it's irrelevant.
Right. The assertion that EPA had no basis, had no evidence, and had actually concluded that non-urban dust is clearly contrary. That was the whole basis for EPA's ultimate decision to not to define a new criterion, in other words, to keep a single criterion for PM coarse. The EPA looked at the fact that we know that there are significant health risks associated with the dusts and the coarse particles that have been looked at, primarily in urban areas. We determined that they share many characteristics with non-urban areas, and therefore, in order to meet the statutory standard to regulate with a adequate margin of safety, we had to utilize the same standard everywhere. Let me turn to the argument as to whether the Supreme Court in Whitman created a new standard, and I think, as Judge Garland was discussing, that argument was already rejected by this court in ATA 3. And I just like the quote from the decision there, where the court said, petitioners misread American Lung Association if they think it requires EPA, prior to setting a primary NAAQS, to identify perfectly safe levels of pollutant, to rely on specific risk estimates, or to specify threshold amounts of scientific information. Although we recognize that the Clean Air Act and circuit precedent require EPA qualitatively to describe the standard governing its selection of particular NAAQS, we've expressly rejected the notion that the agency must establish a measure of the risk to safety it considers adequate to protect public health every time it establishes a NAAQS. Such a rule would compel EPA to leave hazardous pollutants unregulated unless and until it completely understands every risk they pose, thus thwarting the Clean Air Act's requirement that the agency err on the side of caution by setting primary NAAQS that allow an adequate margin of safety. The Act requires EPA to promulgate protective primary NAAQS, even whereas here the pollutants' risks cannot be quantified or precisely identified as to nature or degree. This was this court acting on remand from the Supreme Court in Whitman, and essentially saying that its existing precedent interpreting what the statutory standard to set a level that is protective of public health with an adequate margin of safety means. It means that EPA has to look at to err on the side of safety, and the EPA can regulate, and in fact must regulate, even where there is uncertainty. So therefore, this notion that Whitman change the standard is simply unfounded. What Whitman had in front of it was because this court in ATA 1 did not rule on the validity of the actual standards in front of it. It hadn't applied the statute. The question of how either EPA or this court had applied the standard wasn't in front of the court in Whitman. The only question in front of the court in Whitman was whether the statute itself violated the non-delegation doctrine, and what the court said was no, it did not. That the standard that it be requisite to protect public health was well within the bounds it had set, and it cited to a number of other standards that provided even less guidance to the agency. What the petitioners are trying to argue is that Whitman somehow wrote the adequate margin of safety provision out of the statute, which would, since that was one of the specific instructions that the Congress gave EPA to cabinet's discretion, that would seem a strange result indeed. Let me turn then to the discussion of the level, unless there's further questions on those points. EPA set the level of 150 micrograms per cubic meter for PM10 was based on studies that had demonstrated that areas with level significant levels above that level showed significant associations between health impacts and fine particles, and coarse particles, whereas those below it generally did not. The argument that EPA was somehow compelled to set a different standard for a different level for non-coarse particles essentially fails for the same reasons that the argument that we should have set no standard for non-urban particles fails. EPA was not able to determine that non-urban particles do set a risk, that there is no way to distinguish between urban particles and non-urban particles, that they are a broad mix, that there is a continuum, and therefore there was no basis on which EPA could have set a lower level that would have also met the statutory standard to be requisite.
When you say no way to distinguish between urban and non-urban, do you mean as to the origin of the particles or as to the chemical character?
As to the chemical character, and more importantly, to the level of risk.
Well, you can distinguish dust from other substances, can't you?
Well, most coarse particulate matter is essentially dust, Your Honor. That's what it starts at.
So let's call it crustal matter. Is that the right term?
But what you can't distinguish are crustal materials that pose some sort of risk versus those that don't, because, first of all, it's...
Because elsewhere, as you said, you determined that everything poses some risk.
But evidence poses some risk, and that we just simply don't know what exact elements of when you look at coarse particulate matter, you see all sorts of things in there. There is, silicas. There are metals. There are organic compounds like PAHs that become absorbed onto the coarse particles. There are endotoxins. There are fungi. There's a wide range of materials. And what no one has been able to do is look at and say, okay, no, it's the metals or it's the organics or it's simply the irritation of getting into the lungs. Nobody has been able to tease out those differences. What we do know is that coarse particles in number of studies are associated with both mortality and morbidity effects. That the effects, we see them, the Ostro study, in non-urban areas as well as urban areas, and any of the constituents that we find in urban areas are also found in non-urban areas, such as constituents from highways, constituents from industrial areas. So there's no way to chemically say, to analyze, to collect, for instance, the coarse PM, analyze it chemically and say this mixture poses a risk and this doesn't. When the agency tried to do a proposal, the agency tried to do a geographic distribution and say that areas with low populations were sort of presumed not to have any risk. The comments were overwhelmingly negative from practically every quarter. And what the agency ultimately determined was that that was not a good indicator of risk, that the origin of particles, that some non-urban areas, for instance, contain industrial facilities. Steubenville, Ohio, a small town, has a steel plant where there's been shown an association with mortality. Some areas, such as dry lake beds, might have very high levels of toxic materials. And there may be toxic specific. Nobody's really looked at the petitioners talk, for instance, about agricultural dust and dust arising from agricultural materials, but no one's really studied what to extent those materials might also contribute to risk. And in fact, CASAC criticized EPA for specifically excluding agricultural and industrial sources. So what EPA determined was that it could not use location as a surrogate for risk, that the same kinds of sources, the same types of particulate matter were going to be found in at least some non-urban areas, and that there was simply no way to say, to write a standard that this defined which areas would have low risk from PM and which would not. And therefore, because it couldn't distinguish between areas or types of particulates that posed a risk and those that didn't, under the statute, it regulated them all at the level that it knew addressed the standard with an adequate margin of safety. And finally, briefly talk about the use of the PM10 indicator. As we've described in our brief, the PM10 indicator does include both coarse and fine particles. There are numbers. The use of the indicator is based on a number of things. First of all, there are studies that a number of the studies do link PM10 itself to health risks. Secondly, there is a relationship between fine particles and coarse particles. Areas such as urban areas that have higher concentrations of fine particles, also those fine particles make up more of a contribution to the toxicity of the coarse particles, and therefore regulating either the coarse or the fine particle does address the risks posed by coarse particles, and therefore it is adequate regulation. And what distinguishes this case from ATA-1 is that here the EPA has provided an explanation, which is in the briefs and in the final rule, as to why a standard that does include finding coarse particles specifically addresses the risks from coarse particles. My time's up, and so if there's any questions, I'll.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Questions for them? Okay. Thank you all.
Issue number 3, environmental petitioners issues related to coarse particle standards. Mr. Court for environmental petitioners and Mr. Rave for the EPA.
Good morning again, Paul Court for Environmental Petitioners. I'd like to address just the statutory argument that environmental petitioners raised on EPA's authority to revoke the annual PM10 standard. And that statutory argument is fairly simple. Unlike the ozone provisions, the statutory provisions for PM10 expressly incorporate and depend upon the annual PM10 standard. Section 188D, which is 7513D, specifically relies on the annual standard, and EPA cannot rewrite the statute by revoking the annual standard. The incorporation in 188D also shows Congress's clear understanding of what it meant when it referred to the PM10 standards and other provisions. The authority to review and revise the standard simply does not allow EPA to rewrite the statute and nullify Congress's choices.
So isn't this a Chevron question?
I believe it's a Chevron 1 question, yes.
Well that's a good answer. But only as a debating point.
Well, you didn't cite it.
Chevron.
Did you have Chevron in your brief?
I hope so. But yes, it's a statutory. It's
you're,
a statutory.
You're assuming that this is a clear stat. If this is not clear, that is, if the connection between this section, which talks about exceedances from the annual, that's the only section that discusses the annual concentration.
Right. There's one specific reference.
And there's another specific section which says that the agency can change the.
Right.
Right. So if that combination we would regard as less than clear, we would get to Chevron 2, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Then we would be required to defer to the agency unless it's unreasonable.
Right. And I believe that the Supreme Court has answered the question of whether it's reasonable to allow EPA to rewrite the statute in this way.
You can't rewrite the statute, but it's the in this way part. Which case is that?
Right. So in Whitman, there was a similar issue about revising the 8-hour standard and whether that meant that the subpart 2 requirements could be ignored. And the Supreme Court was very uncomfortable, obviously, with the possibility that through the review and revision of these ozone standards, EPA could nullify the whole statutory scheme governing how these standards would be met, what kind of state implementation plans would be adopted, the level of controls and dates that would have to be achieved. But that's exactly the outcome of EPA's argument here. They can revoke the annual standard. They can revoke the 24-hour standard. There's no PM10 standard at all. Subpart 4 doesn't apply.
A for succinctness. Questions? Thank you, Mr. Carter.
That's a New York minute.
Thank you.
That's a New York minute.
Before I address that argument, my colleague has asked me to provide a cite for the proposition that the PM10 standard is the 24-hour standard is the generally controlling standard, and that's JA 432 in the third column, sort of in the middle of that column. And I'll just note that and move on to the statutory argument. This clearly is a Chevron 2 case, Your Honor. The statute requires EPA to review the NAAQS every 5 years. It requires EPA to revise them as appropriate. Nothing in Section 188 of the statute modified that. This is essentially exactly the same situation that the court addressed in ATA 1. The mere fact that it mentions the annual standard in 188 in terms of a extension provision for the modifications is not sufficient to override, to essentially modify by inference, the requirement that EPA revise the NAAQS. Section 188 was intended to address an immediate issue, and that was when the Act was promulgated in 1990. Congress was concerned that EPA and the states were not moving quickly enough to address PM10, to achieve compliance with the PM10 standard. Therefore, it set up a very short-term scheme where it required areas to be designated. It required them to achieve compliance within 4 to 6 years, and it provided for up to 2 years of extensions. So that while technically the provision could still apply if EPA were to do a new designation for PM10, it hasn't in fact done one for quite a while, the focus of the statute was on a 8 to 10 year period in which states would be designated either moderate or serious non-attainment for PM10. They would submit SIPs for which the requirements are laid out in the statute. They'd either come into compliance or they'd be bumped up to serious, and then that had further ramifications. But it was not intended to lock the PM10 annual standard in place forever. Just as the court recognized in ATA 1, the analogous provisions for ozone were not intended to override the statutory requirement that EPA review the standard and modify as it made sense. And the distinction with Whitman is, Your Honor, in Whitman, EPA, the court was looking at the implementation scheme, which had not yet run. They were still within the time periods. And what the court essentially said was, yes, EPA can modify the ozone standard, but it still has to rectify these two schemes. It has to make them fit together in a way that makes sense. It has to honor the deadlines and the that Congress has established. But those deadlines for PM10 and 188 for the, all the areas that are designated immediately as a result of the statute have long passed. That issue simply doesn't arise in this context.
Their argument about the, this is about 1 hour ozone? About revoking the 1 hour ozone?
They were talking about the annual standard. Oh, the 1 hour, the ozone standard, yes.
And was that, is there a mention of that in the statute in the same way there is for the annual PM10?
No, it simply refers to ozone, but it, as the Supreme Court and this court originally and the Supreme Court on review recognized, that created some inconsistencies because the numerical numbers in, for ozone, the statute actually set up a table and set up limits and then divided areas into classification based on numbers. But those numbers were based on the old ozone standard and weren't directly applicable to the new standard. So what the Supreme Court said was that the EPA, while it could revise the standard, had to essentially reconcile what Congress was trying to do with that schedule and with those divisions. And that simply, I don't believe that concern doesn't arise here because the designations, the time frames for PM10 that Congress was envisioning when it passed the statute in 1990 have come and gone. And there's nothing in the statute that, here EPA found that there was no reason to keep the annual standard for PM10, that there was no studies do not show an association between long-term risks and long-term exposures. Petitioners don't challenge that conclusion, which KSAC also reached. Their only argument is that it should be retained, other than the statutory one, is that it should be retained against short-term problems. But, you know, it's simply unreasonable to read the statute as requiring EPA to keep in place a standard that practically everyone, and certainly KSAC and EPA, agree doesn't make any sense. It serves no purpose. It's simply a meaningless exercise to maintain it when the statute has a very specific provision requiring EPA to review and modify the standards as appropriate. Are there any no further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Ray. Mr. Court, I take it from your earlier presentation that you don't need any rebuttal time. Is that correct? Okay.
Sorry, two issues. I just want to point out. I just would point you to page 1047 of the ATA 1 decision, where this court, in facing the issue on revocation or revision of the 1 hour standard, points out that the state petitioners and Congressman Bliley had argued that that standard was codified, and this court said no. It's that 1 hour standard was not codified, so there's no issue about revising the standard. The court there did not face the question it's facing here. And then the second, I just wanted to respond to EPA's point.
The South Coast case of actually
right, and the
revocation
South
actually takes place rather than just revising.
Right, but in both cases, they deal with the relationship of the authority to review and revise the statute and whether, you know, there's an obligation to maintain.
Is your position they could revise it down to just slightly above zero then? You agree with that? That would be okay?
You mean raise it up so that effectively,
yes,
theoretically they could, and, you know, it may seem absurd, but, you know, Congress spoke to this issue and they codified an annual standard.
There would be no statutory objection to just raising it as high as possible.
Right. They'd still obviously have to offer a reasonable basis.
Well, the reasonable basis is that KSAC and everybody else says there's no need.
And we could address it, you know, then. Yeah. But I want to also point out that the subpart four, these requirements do continue to have effect.
You could have addressed it now.
Well, we did. We did in our brief. We talked about, but I didn't want to rehash that here. The subpart four requirements do continue to have effect because at any time an area can fall out of attainment, and subpart four says you have this many years to get back into attainment, you have to put on these controls. So there is continuing importance for the annual standard and the application of those subpart four requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Court. Thank you all, gentlemen, and Ms. Kennedy. Thank you. Case is submitted.